Good evening. Welcome to Voice to the Voiceless. I'm Bronwyn Franklin, your host. And I want to just share with you around my mental health journey. This is basically a pretty new podcast. And what I want to talk about during most of the podcast, all of the podcasts as we move forward, is mental health. Giving people who really haven't had a voice in their treatment, in their lives, in their journey, in their recovery, the opportunity to talk about their traumas, what has affected them, how their journey has been. So this is what this podcast is about. And I'm going to also share my journey, as well as my incarceration journey and why I do the advocacy work that I do. I don't have any answers, but I have a voice, and my voice had been silent for so long, and now it's time for me to share. So previously I did an introduction to a book that we were reading called Silent Sales. And Silent Sales was a book about how society is beginning to over-medicate. Everything is a mental health diagnosis. And then there's a pill for every mental health diagnosis. And then there's a pill for that pill. And then there's a pill for the side effect from that pill. And on and on and on. And what it has started to do to many of us, include myself, is numb us of emotions, numb us of feelings. It has incarcerated us in our minds. We don't have some time to the ability to think straight, to voice our concerns, and that's where we become voiceless. Because we can't talk about what's really going on or what really happened to us to make us feel that way. You know, it's as simple as and as complex as with the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, there are so many people who have lost loved ones and they're grieving. But leave it to the mental health profession, you're depressed. And you need an antidepressant, you know, and then the antidepressant is going to numb you, slow you down, and get you away from thinking and processing through what is a normal part of grief. Death is a part of life. One thing I've heard when I was a little kid, and it's true. There's two things certain. You will be taxed in America and you will die. No one's going to live forever. Some of us sooner than others. It still hurts. It's still a part of the process. Don't medicate me so that I'm not able to go through and process. Listen to me. Talk to me. Allow me to share and work through the stages of grief. And I talk about that because during the process between July of 2019 and August of 2021, I lost 18 family members. Only one was COVID that we know of. Several were very close to me. One was my father. And I think if you go back through some older podcasts when I first started, there's a tribute to him on here of some of the music that he liked to listen to. He was a jazz fan. But I say all that to say, COVID has also brought people to a place of trauma that they've not experienced before. And these layers of trauma not only include grief, but they also include isolation. We as a people were meant to collaborate, communicate, interact, socialize. In the eight dimensions of wellness that I will talk about as we move on in these podcasts, one of those dimensions to be able to balance in your life is to be able to have socialization, being able to connect. I have a spiritual belief. I'm not a religious person. I am, but I have spiritual beliefs, and I do believe in the Bible. And it was created that man should not live alone. He was created to have a partner was created for him. So many of us are already isolated, and the only social interaction we might have had was going to work or going to the grocery store. Because there's a lot of single people out here. There's a lot of elderly people. To have put us in a for us to have been in a pandemic where we were isolated in our homes for almost who knows how long. Many of us are getting out. Some of us are not. That isolation is, for me, a precursor to depression. When I isolate, or when I am isolated, or I am feeling isolated, I start to feel down. And when you are not connecting or communicating with anybody, you're talking, you have this monologue going on in your head. And there's all types of things. It could be, you know, I'm not worthy, I'm useless, it's hopeless. I don't know what your monologue tells you, but I do know what mine would tell me. So I say a lot of that to just kind of share again some of the topics that's going to be talked about as we move through these podcasts. And hopefully I will have individuals come on and share their journey with mental health, their journey with trauma. And also, and not excluded of our trauma from the pandemic, because that's a whole nother layer of trauma. But tonight, I want to talk about criminal justice. Criminal justice. And we've heard the term pipeline to prison. You know, school is a pipeline. Some schools, the education system is a pipeline to prison. And I believe that is true. It's not absolute, but I believe it's true. And I believe it's true in urban areas for people of color. And I say that because my background is I was born and raised in Detroit, Michigan, in the Detroit public school system. And I was raised in an era where we had the big three automotive company. And that had been what kept this city, vital and alive. That was where our prosperity came from. So our school system sucked. Because basically, it was a pipeline. You just get through school, just graduate. And your dad, your uncle, your cousin, your mom, maybe even your mother, would just get you a job at the plant. You work at the plant. Well, the late 1970s rolled around and the job market, they started outsourcing cars to different places overseas. Plants start closing up. Recession hit. The neighborhoods got flooded with crack in the early 80s. So basically all the people who had gotten this faulty education had no jobs to go to. Some of them may have felt hopeless. I don't know. Many of them turned to using drugs. Many of them turned to selling drugs. Anyway, the school system sucked. So then it didn't improve. It didn't change. So the same education that was given to me in the 60s and the 70s is the same education that was being given in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And there was no jobs because no one really had an education. I was an honor roll student. I maintained a B plus A average throughout school. However, my English writing skills suck. I don't write very good paragraphs, or my punctuation is not the best when it comes to writing. Pronouncing certain words, being able to sound a word out. I'm not skilled at that. I wasn't taught that. I was just passed along. No one addressed it. So the big industry, the next big industry after we lost the automotive industry here in the United States, became prison. And prison became privatized. So not only did it go from you just go through school to go to the automotive companies, you just go through school to go to prison. And rehabilitation in prison is a joke. So here I am, a Black woman with a mediocre education, with a trunk full of childhood trauma. And I'm not sure if any of you ever heard of the adverse childhood experience, the ACEs study that was done. It was done predominantly middle-class white people, California. But there is a Philadelphia ACE study, which is more around the things that happen and occur in urban areas or around people with color. But just looking at the original ACE study, which I didn't discover until probably 2013, sitting in a meeting in Portland, Oregon, on a trauma team, and I looked at the different pieces that identify trauma, and there's only 10 questions. And at the time, I was able to say I had 9 of those out of 10. Per that study, it explains why I was suicidal, why I smoked cigarettes for so many years. And it explains so much about my mental health state and why I had struggled so long. And through the grace of God, I'm still alive, because according to that study, I should have been a drug addict and I should be dead by now. But that wasn't meant to be. I was meant to be here to tell this story, to help someone else along their journey. As I looked through the Philadelphia ACE study, I can relate more to that. But that's another podcast about my trauma history. But it's pretty deep, it's pretty extensive, and it's not stopped. And I hold on to a scripture that says, if it doesn't, God won't put no more on you than you can bear. And I found that to be true. So I went through school. I didn't say I didn't have behavioral issues. I didn't have behavioral issues in school, but I had behavioral issues at home. And what I've learned from that as I work in the mental health field is, and it's true, behavioral issues come from an unmet need. Doesn't mean that the person or the child is bad or they're out of whatever. There's a need. What's missing? What happened to them? What's happening to them? We need to stop and look at these things instead of just brushing them under the rug or tossing them to the side, medicating the children, putting them in foster care, which is another trauma, which you just took them away from, even though it might have not been the best stable environment, but it was the only stable environment they knew. And you threw them in a completely different foreign everything. And you're going to get some behavior that's maybe not the best behavior. But anyway, back to. So, yeah, I had a lot of challenges. I had a lot of struggles. I managed to graduate high school. I was very rebellious, very headstrong. But I still struggled with mental health. I can see dark days starting around the age of 7, where I would isolate, where I would cry. I cried a lot. Very insecure. And that continued on. And all I ever, and I had this longing to be loved because I didn't feel loved. And that continued on. First suicide attempt was age 13. Second suicide attempt was 17. All these were with my thing was pills, medication. And I had a strong hate for medication because I had substance use in my family. My father was a heroin addict. And then my mom was an alcoholic, which, you know, back then it was just normal stuff that I thought. It was normal for my household. That's how we lived. Second suicide attempt was around 23, and I think that was the onset of. Nope, sorry, take it back. There was one at 17, but then there was another one around 19. And I think part of that also had to do with that one. And at 23, I think had a lot to do with postpartum. It was not long. It was within 2 years of having both my sons. The one at age 23, because the pills had failed so many times, I wanted to go over the overpass into the highway. That got me my first hospitalization. Up until that point, I hadn't been hospitalized, just medicated. Which I do like so many other people do, is I take the medication till I feel better and I stop. because I didn't like the way it made me feel. I didn't like the way it kept me groggy, how it kept me foggy inside, how it made me want to eat or just sleep. I didn't like the physical feelings I was getting from the medication. And that's what the book Silent Sale talks a little bit, a lot about that. Because it is a silent sale. You're in a cell like a prison cell, but it's silent because it's in your brain. So anyway, I continued on. After the hospitalization, I struggled with college because I couldn't stay focused, couldn't concentrate. I was a single mom, I had been single so many times, because I kept looking for love in all the wrong places. And I kept latching on to or getting in relationships with people that were struggling with their own issues. And it just was all the wrong reasons. And that continued. And the struggle continued, and the up and down continued with the medications, on and off the medications, in and out of mental health treatment, no hospitalizations, but just in and out, in and out. Finally, around 35, I had an episode where I had been so stressed out, and I was working. I finally had landed a good job at 30. I had landed a great job at 30. I was making great money, but I was working, overtime, all the time, a lot of work. And I was in another one of those toxic relationships. And I was just, steady trying to help build this man up to be successful at something. And I was steady bringing me down further and further. I took and came home and I was cycling. I didn't realize that I had been on some medication prior to that. Because my job and I was stressed and I had been on some medication, they had put me on Prozac for depression because I was depressed. And that's how I had been diagnosed, as depressed. And it wasn't helping. And they just kept increasing the milligrams, So I was on the highest dose. I was on 80 milligrams. Can't get any higher. And I did what I always do. I stopped taking it because it wasn't helping. Well, that triggered a manic, and I didn't sleep more than 4 hours a day for over 4 months, from May till September. My irritability increased. My darkness increased. And I was going back and forth contemplating suicide again. And I was working every day. Until one night, I just said I was fed up. And in the midst of going for the pills that I had been stockpiling, the guy I was dating at the time tried to intervene. There was a big fight. It got physical. He almost died. I went from suicidal to homicidal in a matter of seconds. They diagnosed it as psychotic because it was like what people describe as having an out-of-body experience. It was like I was across the room watching the actions that I was committing. I was so disconnected from myself. My 13-year-old son was in the house and he came into the room because he heard the noise. And that's what brought me back. Somehow I had disassociated. I had no prior criminal record, no prior anything. Long story short, I go to jail, I get out, I'm on bond. And there's a difference between jail and prison. Eventually, they lock me back up in jail. I'm being forced medicated with a klonopin, which is an opioid. Now I'm finally diagnosed as having bipolar disorder. And I didn't get diagnosed prior to that because all of the different behaviors that I had and the bad behaviors, I thought that was normal. Because those were behaviors I saw in my family, behaviors I saw from my mother, behaviors I saw from my grandmother, behaviors that I had seen. So it was like normal family stuff. This is what family, but they diagnosed it as bipolar. Anyway, so the judge decides that I have two choices. I can go to the forensic center and let them hold me there until I'm able to stand trial. And that could be 10, 15, 20 years. And then I still have to come to trial and still might get 10, 15, 20 years. So I had that option or take a plea. And I took a plea. And what I pled to was not what I got sentenced to. So what I pled to was like 4 years and I got double that. So they gave me a sentence of 10 to 20. So 10 years to 20 years in prison. Wow. I don't remember the first 6 months. I was so medicated that I don't remember the first 6 months. I just remember me saying that if anything happened to my mother or my children, I would die. God won't put no more on you than you can bear. So, fast forward. Within months of that, my oldest son, who was supposed to have been going away to college, who was on the dean's list, he gets in trouble and he gets a double murder case in Ohio. So now he's doing life without parole because he took a plea. Okay, that's something just happened to one of my children. Oh my God. And I had three children out at the time, ranging from the age of 18 to 10. Wow. Okay. What a blow. So I started unpacking my diagnosis at first, find out what that was about. Then I realized I had an identity issue. I didn't have an identity of myself. I was so connected to everybody else and all these other toxic people that I had no identity. I didn't know who Bronwyn was. You know, Bronwyn didn't have dreams and goals anymore. Bronwyn didn't know her personality because I had been so connected to all these other toxic people and wanting to help and fix and all of that and caretaking, all kinds of, it was great stuff. It was just with a toxic background. So we go on. This is in 1999. So now I'm in prison. Now my oldest son is in prison. Wow. So I'm unpacking all this stuff around the bipolar, all the symptoms, what it might, where it comes from or how it might come about, you know, because the one thing I ever wanted in life, didn't want to happen, was to be away from my children. Sounds stupid when I said I wanted to commit suicide. Makes no sense to me. Anyway. But here I am away from my children and I'm not raising them. So I continue to do this work. I get into my Bible. I get into these books. I finally get into school where I can finish my associate's degree. And the sad part about it is the state of Michigan decided they were going to stop the program. And I think I was like 5 credit hours short of the degree. So now I've been trying to get a degree for 30 years. No, 20 years, from 18 to 38. However, the university gave me credit and I was able to get the degree, which was awesome. That was a boost to my self-worth. Moving on, 2003, my mother dies from cancer. They told her they called it liver cancer. But I call it cirrhosis of the liver because she had been drinking and drinking and drinking so long all her life. You know, it's a wonder my brother, and I don't know about myself, but my brother wasn't born with fetal alcohol syndrome, because that was the joke when she was pregnant with him, is you hide your gin and you hide your barbecue. Because when she came, she was drinking up all the gin and she was eating up all your barbecue. So there it is again. Don't let nothing happen to my children or my mother. Blam. One son's locked up doing life without parole. From the dean's list to the prison. Holy crap. Now my mom's gone. Wow. God won't put no more on you than you can bear. Made it through it step by step. So 2006 rolls around. And I'm getting ready to see the parole board because I'm supposed to be paroled that August. So, March 29th, I get a visit. And it's my dad and my nephew. And the scene is familiar because when there's a notification of death, because my dad came to tell me about my mom, they don't let you go into the regular visiting room. They put you off to a side to another room. And my dad and my nephew were crying. And they came to tell me that my youngest son was on life support. He had been shot in the head. And at this point, it was two questions. Do we keep him on life support because he's brain dead? And do we do organ donations? That was the second question. So my answer was do the organ donations and don't prolong the suffering, because life support is not quality life. It may be quantity, but it's not quality. My son was 21 years old. And during the midst of this conversation, everybody's crying, everybody's upset. And my nephew is talking, you know, he wants to seek revenge and all this other dumb stuff. And because that's the mentality. And again, I stepped into the role that I always step into, the parent, the boss, the person in authority. You know, even though my 70-something year old dad was sitting there. And I was basically, no, you know, you're not going to do this. Yes, they grew up like brothers. I raised this young man, my nephew. He lived in my house. He grew up with my kids like brothers. And he didn't understand that. And I had to break it down like this. I'm sitting here because I almost killed somebody and I want someone to forgive me. My oldest son is incarcerated in Ohio, accused of killing somebody or killing two people or whatever the story is. I don't know because I'm still locked up. But I want someone to forgive him. And because I say I believe in this Bible, it says I have to give forgiveness in order to receive forgiveness. So we need to forgive this young man and pray for him and his mother. Because I know what that feels like to be in his position almost. And I know definitely what it feels like to be in her position, to know that your child is being accused of this. That enlightened my dad, who was in his 70s at the time, and my nephew, because it made so much more sense. It was a profound statement from somebody who had so many tragedies. And my dad had to say, you know, every time I come in here with something, some bad news, expecting I have to console you, you console us. And that was 5 months before I was supposed to get my parole. Prison system sucks. My son was not in a gang. He was not affiliated with a gang, but because of his age and the way he was shot, that was the rumor that it may have been gang related. My son had developed schizophrenia. He was showing signs of schizophrenia. He had started showing signs around 15. My family, as many Black families do, we are denial that it's anything wrong. Mental health does not happen in Black families. Mental health is not something we talk about. And a lot of it is because we distrust the system so much. We have been experimented on. We have been taken for granted, imprisoned, just all types of things. But we don't trust systems. So no, you're not, there's nothing wrong. It was blamed on drug use. As far as I know, my son may have been a weed smoker, marijuana smoker. But I don't know about anything other than that. And that's one thing about me. I'm not going to say, oh no, he didn't, or no, he wasn't, because I wasn't there. And if my eyes aren't on you, I can't say what you will do and what you won't do, because my eyes not there. But anyway, he started having these problems. And I mean, consider this child's trauma history. You know, his father went to prison before he was born and was still in prison doing 20-something years. His stepdad was a crack addict. His mom just went to prison from attempted murder. And his brother is in prison for murder. And all this happened before he was 14 years old. I can see some mental health stuff going on. And then also understand this. For me, I was a heavy marijuana smoker up until the age of 21. When it started causing me to have some mental health challenges. It started to have extreme paranoia. Extreme paranoia. Can't leave the house. Can't go outside. Don't want to open the door. I'm being watched. I'm being followed. I can't say that was the marijuana. I don't know what it was. But to this day, I don't smoke marijuana. And that was almost 40 years ago. I think with a chemical imbalance, that may have triggered some chemical issues. And with my son, there may have been some chemical imbalances. There's already some mental health stuff going on. There's already that. You know, I have it. And I think it's some family stuff. So marijuana may have triggered something. I don't know. Anyway. So fast forward. They didn't deny me my parole, but they held me an extra 6 months because, again, the rumor was this was gang related. I had to really have a hard time getting officers to even take me to the viewing of my son because it was gang related, you know, which was a bunch of crap, you know, just people just cruel and make stuff up because they can. You know, 21-year-old kid gets shot in the head. Oh, it has to be gang related. BS. You know, again, stereotyping black community. Garbage. You know, and then hold me 6 more months with the thought of, oh, she may go to retaliate. BS. Or she may not be mentally strong. We got to observate her. Those were the rumors that went around. But because other than that, they had no reason to hold me. I had did everything they had asked me to do. And I had no tickets. And the thing is, I had no tickets before I went in. I had no traffic tickets. I had no criminal history. I struggled with mental health was my only crime through life until that point. Well, the only crime I got caught for. Just keeping it real. So I say all that because I'm going to be coming to an end, but something happened the other day that sent me into a whole together different state of mind about our criminal justice system. So as it stands now, I don't have a problem with I have a problem with some of our criminal justice stuff because basically there's no rehabilitation. There's no serious look at mental health. There's no serious look at trauma. So the young man that actually shot my child was 15 years old. I unfortunately seen it on the news before they came and told me. I had no idea it was my child. I just knew it was in the neighborhood we lived in. I looked at the fact that it was five young kids between 13 and 15, at least 3 or 4 blocks away from home at 11 o'clock at night on a Sunday night. First of all, the way I grew up in the 60s and the 70s was you have your behind at home when the streetlights get on. At 14, 15 years old, you better be somewhere and your parents know where you were at. These kids were 2 or 3 blocks, at least 2 or 3 blocks away from home, and 2 of them had guns. Where were the parents? This is on a Sunday night. You should have school in the morning. So why are you out on the street? So those was red flags to me. Nobody's looking at that. Nobody looked at that. Nobody did anything about that. Nobody thinks about stuff like that, but I think about that because I know when I was a parent and my children was home, even though he had to be somewhere and I knew where he was at. You know, 17, 18, you need to be somewhere, and you better be, if you're on the block, you better be where I can still put my eyes on you. Or you better be in distance enough where I can call your name and you can respond. So that troubled me. That bothered me. That bothered me. It still bothers me because there's so many of these children, because I know what it's like to raise myself and be out and raise children younger than me. But we still had some rules and regulations. So a couple of days ago, somebody had told me about a friend of ours in the neighborhood that was supposed to be being released from prison. This is somebody doing life. Another situation where I think there was a lot of trauma in that household that nobody knew about, you know, and this, because the heinousness of this young man's behavior started at 9 years old. And nobody investigated to see what was causing this horrendous behavior. And it continued on up until his adulthood, until he got life in prison, and it still continued in the prison. But they told me he was being released, and I was like, no, it's no way. So I went on what they call OTIS, Michigan Offenders Tracking System. And I looked it up, and yeah, he's still in prison. However, I decided to look up the young man's name who had murdered my son in 2006. And I prayed that this boy would get his life back on track and he would do better. Because at 15, he only had to do 2 years for murdering my son. Assault with intent to do great bodily harm less than murder. Didn't get the murder charge. Didn't get the gun charge. It's a long story to that. He didn't get caught till a couple of months later. Blah, 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 blah. Couldn't be ID'd. No gun. Whatever. Well, when I looked up his name, he's in prison. Again. He's only doing 2 years again. Now, this is the first time he's been to prison since in his life. This is his first time going to prison. He didn't go to prison. He went to juvenile for my son. He's charged with driving by and shooting up a house. He's got 2 felonious assaults. 4 gun charges, driving by, shooting from a vehicle, shooting at a house, whatever, blah, blah, blah. But 2 years again. Our system is flawed. At first, I was so angry and I was so mad because I had asked for forgiveness and I had prayed for this child to have learned his lesson. You know, and he has not. The pain ripped me so deep, and I was so angry. And at that point, I almost turned to wanting revenge. But then I had to go back and think about it again and think about the whole scenario and the whole journey of it. The system has been failing this young man for 31 years. He's 31 years old. Somehow or another, whatever traumas that have been in his family or in his life brought him to the point where he was able to murder someone at the age of 15. And it's obvious at the age of 30, he still has no conscience of how wrong it is to take another person's life. He took my son's life over something petty. As far as I know, I've heard two separate stories. I just recently heard a different story. But the original story was my son, because he was suffering from mental illness, was on the street panhandling. And he was at the gas station pumping gas for change and washing windows, windshield. And they was harassing him. And he didn't think that they had guns. So he had a little pocket knife, and he pulled a pocket knife, and they pulled guns, and they chased him across major street, because he was in the neighborhood where we grew up at. So he knew where I grew up. He grew up. He knew a lot of people. His dad grew up. He knew a lot of people. So he was headed to the block we grew up on. He was only a block away when they shot him. And I read a report that was written in 2006 or 2007 around the high number of homeless people that are murdered. And my son was in that article. And the guy said he just wanted to fuck up the homeless man. That was the reason they shot him. Just because they wanted to fuck up the homeless man. Are you kidding me? So he hasn't learned anything. He hasn't gotten any help. I looked at the rap sheet and I looked at all the tattoos. So it sounds like he's been living a gang life. He's been skating and getting away. He's skating and getting away again. I'm angry because he keeps skating and getting away. He's not getting any help. And it's obvious at this point he has no conscience. So he's going to be free again to murder again or shoot up somebody else's house. And that infuriates me. But here it is. I have a son who never got in trouble before, who was a bookworm. And he's doing life without the ever possibility of parole. Whereas this kid has killed one person, shot up another house later. And so he's committed multiple crimes. But he needs some help. So that was my whole reason for coming on here tonight is to talk about that and my feelings, because I feel like I need to do something. I got to do something, and I just don't know what to do because I'm angry. This kid needs some help. I don't know if I want to reach out. But is that the right thing to do? I don't know. But I already know. 2 years, he hasn't learned anything. There's no rehabilitation. Prison is not a rehabilitation. It's a holding cell where they can collect money because it's been privatized. It is another scheme on the high ranking end, just like the pharmaceutical companies. It's all about bodies and dollars. And the mental health in prison, after there's no mental health hospitals, these people are in bed together. Send all the people with mental health issues to prison and feed them the pharmaceuticals. Mandate that they take these pharmaceuticals. And when they parole, they still have to be mandated to take them. I was one of those people. I've been home now since 2007. And I've been working on rebuilding my life and unpeeling all these layers and all this stuff of trauma. And it takes me back to the ACEs study. Because as I've been unpacking and looking at this journey, I realized that I did have all 10. The one that I was just blocking out was being molested. And as I learn about sexual assault and what sexual assault looks like, what happened to me was not, I was not physically penetrated, but I was sexually assaulted by two separate people. So that original ACEs study, I have all 10. But what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And none of that killed me. It did make me stronger. And God did not put no more on me than I can bear. And because I bear it with strength, with grace, I try to give grace and mercy and forgiveness back. So that kind of concludes Voice to the Voiceless for tonight. I look forward to sharing more in the upcoming weeks, having some special guests come on to share their journey, to share their story. And hopefully, we can make some changes in the systems. That's all for now. Thank you. This is Bronwyn Franklin for Voice to the Voiceless. Good night.